Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Hello, and welcome to Radio Oldie with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And I'm delighted to be interviewing the distinguished journalist and writer Matthew Norman, and also the writer of our brilliant Grumpy Oldie Man column. Now, Matthew, some people are glass half full, some are glass half empty. How full is your glass today?
A half empty would be a utopian dream that I would never expect to realise. I'm a very, very depressive, resigned, pessimistic Jew, and I'm proud of it.
And always have been?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah.
And your late parents, you've written about very movingly in the Oldie, were they grumpy and very funny?
My mother was hilarious, absolutely hilarious. And my dad was much drier, quieter man. The narcissism gene comes entirely from my mother's side of the family. So he was very thoughtful, bright, studious, decent, honourable, old-fashioned kind of Englishman. And she was a sort of exhibitionist, but very, very funny and sharp.
And do you think the two go together? I think that if you're at all observant about life, you will notice, A, how dreadful most human beings are, but you will also spot patterns and then begin to be funny about them. Do you think so? Grumpiness and humour go together, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, comedians on the whole are not happy people. I'm not saying I'm a comedian, but I think, you know, there's very little humour that stems from contentment. It's a bit like that quote from The Third Man, you know, about Switzerland's cultural output. 500 years of peace and one of their produce the cuckoo clock. And I think it's similar with comedy, yeah.
Is that because of intense observational powers? Why should that go together?
Because there's nothing remotely intrinsically funny about success and contentment and peace. Humour tends to stem from failure and despair, and Jews are traditionally funny because, you know, you need to be funny, the harder things are. And now we see a lot of young Asian comedians coming from fairly deprived, difficult, you know, race-baity kind of backgrounds. But there aren't a lot of great comedians, for example, from the English aristocracy.
Yep.
You know, there are very few Dukes winning the Perrier Award at Edinburgh.
And even someone like P.G. Woodhouse is an insider, isn't he? He went to Dulwich, but he wasn't a
senator. Yeah, he's an outlier.
Didn't go to university, yeah.
You can't begin to account for genius on that scale, can you, and source it. It's just a miracle.
Yes, yeah. Brilliant education, like you, a classicist.
But probably a rather more attentive and successful classicist than I was. Indeed, he's more like you in that he was a very clever and resourceful classicist.
You attended Westminster School, where you were a successful classicist, and you were taught by the great Theo Zinn, who was a tremendous teacher, wasn't he?
Well, he was a tremendous man, really. He was I don't think he'd get a start in education now, to be honest, in an age, you know, of uniformity. But in those days, all sorts of eccentric people were teaching in private schools. And that had its good and bad sides, but it brought a different perspective, I think. The amount of privilege, I'm still embarrassed and ashamed of the amount of privilege that my life was involved.
What sort of things?
Well, that.
Going to an
where I grew up, the lack of worry about.
Where did you grow up?
In Highgate, near Kenwood House, the most beautiful part of London. And my son is also embarrassed about having been to a fee-paying school. I mean, I obviously politically I found them abhorrent in the extreme. And not so much them as the need for them or the perceived need for them. And when I was at Westminster, I think, you know, my friends and me, we just assumed that by the time we had children, they wouldn't be required. They'd only be snob schools.
This was in the early 80s you went to?
This was in the late 70s.
Yeah.
But to grow up in that, you know, I mean, architecturally, the beauty of it.
I went to the same school and completely took for granted going to Westminster Abbey three times a week.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just in what we used to call the little yard, just the beauty of it. And even at the time, I thought I couldn't quite believe it was like being in Narnia or something.
But
I think one should feel guilty about these things when, you know, half the country is queuing up at food bags or whatever. I'm one of those smug, bleeding art liberals that I would cross a continent to avoid.
So what was the conversation you had with yourself or with your wife on sending your son to one of these schools?
Well, it was a very simple one, because at the time, this is going back, you know, more than 20 years, our part of West London, Shepherd's Bush, he'd have been torn to pieces on his first day. There was no... Now, I think there are some quite decent secondary schools. But just by temper and the nature, he was not cut out for it. He's a very dreamy, kind of creative person. So, you know, it's awful, but it was, I think, in the right thing in those specific circs.
And Matthew, you were all headed to go to Oxford to read classics, and then what happened in your interview there?
Well, you say I was headed, which is a fantastically vague term. It's like saying that, you know, the British economy is headed for golden pastures. Because I was not very bright, and unbelievably idle. And in those days, if you could tie a shoelace and tell the time, if you were taught by the people who taught us, it was much harder not to get to Oxford than to get there. But I managed that feat. Well, I was sitting in the interview, because you had all these, I think you still do, but you have these bespoke exams in the winter for Oxford. And there was one, I can't remember which paper it was, it must have been Greek literature. And I'd written an essay on Euripides' Alcestis. I think we were kind of primed, you know, what the set texts were. Yeah. And when I was sitting in this interview with these three dons at Trinity College, Oxford, it became very plain very quickly that they hadn't been tremendously impressed with my essay. And they were quite, not aggressively, but within the context, they were being quite firm about wanting my sources. And eventually, after about 10 minutes, I had to admit that the essay in its entirety, the only source material was the blurb on the back of the Penguin translation. At which point I said, I didn't say I'll get me coat, because that catchphrase hadn't been invented. But I think I said that I felt that we'd spent long enough together and it was probably time for me to depart.
You had delighted them long enough.
I hadn't delighted them at all, no. It was one among maybe 500 moments of exquisite embarrassment in my life. Which you know, every time I wake up at 3:30, one of them flashes to mind and I pull that sort of munt face and the scream. And that's on the rotor.
Which has then, you've then mined them for comic gold, because in your terrific column, The Oldie, you seem to be dogged by misfortune. Things like, most recently, trying to get an insurance quote in Shepherd's Bush, which had been hit by an unusual bout of extreme weather.
Yes, I mean, I don't think this is unique, insurance companies being what they are. Yeah, no, it had gone up from something like £400 a year to 16 in the quote, the automatic renewal quote.
£1,600.
It had gone up, it had quadrupled, pretty much. Because they said they had detected new weather patterns in the area. So I got onto the, I think it was outsourced, the PR people, and discussed it. And I said I must have missed the cyclone or whatever. And they said they'd get back to me and explain, but I was still waiting. So I did the usual thing of going on. And this is where this is very anti-oldies, because people like my parents' generation aren't really up, you know, don't have the capacity to do this. But I just went online, did the quote thing, and it came out at cheaper than the previous years. Yes. So they hadn't, the other firms hadn't been apprised of these new weather patterns yet.
Because there are genuinely greater sources of grumpiness now, aren't there? Things like being ripped off. I have to do that every year with my insurance. You didn't have to do that. So yeah. You've got to be more aggressive or grumpy or spot people behaving badly, haven't you?
Well, you have. It's very tiresome. I mean, I don't think human nature's changed much in the last, 150,000 years, but the technology, which is really what's destroying the world, or what's the catalyst for the destruction of the world, technology makes it so easy for people to be crooks.
And to replace...
Or legalise crooks in this case.
Yeah, and replace humans with machines who don't answer the phone so quickly.
Yes, I mean, we all spend half our lives waiting, listening to that music that makes you want to take a knife to your gizzards. Yes. Modern life is, I mean, it's what old people say, old people like me. But actually, with this generation, because I think our parents, who are a similar vintage, yours are a bit younger, but they had the absolute best of it. The ones who grew up during the war, maybe born in the war, but too young to be, to be scared. And then there was that golden era, wasn't
there? Just missed National Service, or did you?
Dad missed it. And then they had like 50, I think the golden era of modern humanity is probably 1946 to 1979. And I'm continuing. But, I mean, I think the Thatcher-Reagan axis sort of shifted the sensibilities of the Western world, or set it in motion.
And my answer to all problems, cheap house prices. I bet your parents, like my parents, bought.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you could buy a lovely house for 3,000 quid. It'd probably be 2 million now. But for various reasons. It was easy. Life was easy. You could get a mortgage with a very low salary. But also there was a sense of freedom there, which I don't think my son or anyone under 40 has any idea about. And they wouldn't even consciously feel that. But we live in a surveillance society now.
Freedom to do what? What can you do that your dear son can't do?
Well, crime, for instance. If I was a criminal, in those days, I could have laundered money easily. I could have burgled people. There were very few CCTV cameras. Now you can't drive without on a motorway, every 5 seconds as someone's taking a picture of your face, and you don't feel it, but you not consciously, but subconsciously, there's almost, you can't move now without leaving a trail.
Some more serious-minded, po-faced listeners might say it's quite good that criminals aren't so free.
Yeah. Well, the criminals aren't so free. Well, they're much freer in some ways in the sense of being a functioning police force. So it swings and roundabouts.
Yeah.
So I'm not really talking about the chances, because I was thinking recently, the stage of my career and general finances, that crime would be the best career for me.
What sort of criminal would you like to be?
I think I'd like to be a cat burglar, but for obvious reasons, that's not a runner.
Because of the excitement?
No, because I don't think there's the prospects of being caught are so minimal. And in fact, police don't really investigate burglary. They would if it was around, in central London, in Belgravia. But, outside a high tariff area, you'd have to be caught in the act to have any chance of being caught.
Or pull off one of the great crimes of all time. I believe you were friends with some of the perpetrators of one of the great crimes of recent
years. Well, exactly. And again, these guys, this is the Hatton Garden heist that we all enjoyed so much for its sort of nostalgic charms. And these guys were all 70s, early 70s, or later, or older. And they hadn't cottoned on to the fact that if they, A, that they would be photographed a lot, and B, that they were carrying mobile phones. And if it was you and me, we'd carry burners.
Yeah.
Wouldn't we? Those cheap phones.
Some of those,
well, there was a chap called Billy Lincoln, who, I go to this Turkish bar, and I hope you'll be a guest soon.
Absolutely, extremely enjoyable.
Which used to be, and not quite so much now, but was a sort of repository for some of the great characters of London. Not all of them entirely law-abiding people. We had quite a few cons there. And it's the most wonderful democratic place. Because
Porchester Road, is that right?
Porchester Road in Bayswater, West 2. Lots of villains, but you see, I have literally seen a high court judge soaping someone who'd just come out of Belmarsh. So I think there's nothing like nudeness for promoting egalitarianism. You can't be grand when your dangly bits are flopping all over the shop. I don't know.
There may be sending you down for a
It wasn't quite like the porridge episode of Maurice Denham as a judge.
Yes.
But anyway, Billy Lincoln was one of our brethren, who's a bright guy, I think probably from, I don't know where he's from, but working class guy. And quite of the muscular right. So we'd have political debates. We had bet on an election, which of course he won on when Cameron won in 15. And then not long after... he was a curmudgeon, which I like, obviously.
Tough on law and order, was he?
Not on himself. I think it was, do as I say, not as I do with Billy. And then one day I came in and he said, and he was known as Billy the Fish in the trial, because three or four times a week he was down Billingsgate at 4 in the morning buying fish, which he then sell. He said, Matthew, he said, do you like fish? I said, well, yes, Bill, I do. He said, I'll tell you what, he said, next time I'm down Billingsgate, I'm going to get you a beautiful Dover sole. He said, I'll be in Wednesday. You'll be here? I said, I will. He said, right. Well, that Wednesday, I'm on the lounger upstairs, cooling off. And he comes over with this massive, beautiful Dover sole. And I said, Bill, this is extraordinarily kind. He said, well, I told you, didn't I? I said, what do I owe you? He said, now, don't go pulling my bell end, Matthew, he says. He says, I told you, it's a mark of respect and friendship. Don't start with me. Don't want nothing for it. Just, I said, well, Bill, this is extraordinarily kind. Thank you so much. He said, think nothing of it. So I went downstairs back in the steam room And I said, Billy Lincoln, what's happened to Billy Lincoln? He's just given me this, you know, in a restaurant that would cost you 100 quid, that fish. In Scots. And he said, I know, it's extraordinary, isn't it? He said, he's like buying everyone coffee and sandwiches. He's beaming. He used to be such a bad-tempered old git. And I said, there's no explanation for this. It's completely... But there was an explanation, because at 4:30 the next morning, in a dawn raid, he was arrested in connection with the Hatton Garden heist, for which he was chief fence. And like all the others, he got a 7 stretch in Belmarsh. Did 3.5. Out he came.
No disrespect to Billy the Fish, but it was one of the stupidest crimes of all time, wasn't it?
Well, it was a brilliant crime in the sense that they did it and they got away, but in the sense that they had all been carrying mobile phones that lived digital signals, it wasn't so much stupid as anachronistic, really. They just didn't understand the modern world and modern communications.
And Basil the Fence is still on the loose?
I think they got him in the end, didn't they? Yeah. But, I mean, you wouldn't want to be in Belmarsh now. A few years in Ford would be lovely, refreshing.
You quite like porridge.
You could catch up with your reading and, yeah.
Yeah, and the Jeffrey Archer wing.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, penal reform is perhaps one for another day.
Yes. And Matthew, to return to your career, you've written brilliantly in all sorts of forms. Feature writer for the Mail on Sunday.
Mm.
Television reviewer for the Evening Standard. Mm. Sad story, the Evening Standard, isn't it?
Oh,
it's God. Now a once-weekly magazine, which is no good.
Is it not? I haven't seen it. I mean,
it's have terrific writers, not least you, but it used to be one of the great papers. Correspondents across the world.
Oh, my God, of all the papers I work for, it's my favourite.
Because?
Just excitement, you know, the immediacy, you know.
Three editions they used to have, didn't they?
Oh, it was a wonderful, wonderful paper. And, you know, a city like this it's extraordinary that a city of this size and vibrancy doesn't have a newspaper anymore.
Yeah. And they used to, you know, famously Maxwell tried to set one up, didn't he? It was a fort for property, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. And I think the commercial possibilities are enormous. I mean, you know, you could have apps that could do all sorts of things, but it seems to have been completely wasted. So that's the sadness.
And then you were absolutely brilliant diarist on The Guardian, where one of your friends or foes is the new British ambassador to America.
Yeah. Well, when I started there, which was 1995, so 2 years before Labour came to power, I had the field of hating New Labour and finding Blair and his coterie repulsive.
From the beginning, did you?
Oh, yeah.
You could see that it was all smoke and mirrors, could you?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I could see he was a charlatan, and I could, you know, a plausible charlatan and a sort of narcissistic maniac. But there was no one else having a go, maybe Private Eye. But so I had that most of that ground to myself.
Because they were still mistily in love with the
people. Yeah. And I went to conferences and I saw these grizzled old hacks looking up at Blair. And it was like people looking at Jesus in a Renaissance triptych, you know, the adoration of the Blair. And I just completely, I never understood it.
I do think that's why they were so bad at being teased, because you became a sort of frenemy of Peter Mandelson, now the British ambassador to America. He came round to dine at your house, didn't he?
Quite a few times, but the first few years of it was like a psychotic feud in which he'd try and get people to... He'd organise letter-writing campaigns, try and get me sacked. Because I gave him his nickname, which is nothing to be tremendously proud of, because any four-year-old in the playground who met a Mandelson would call him Mandy.
What year was that?
95.
And you really minded?
Oh, I hated it. He got Gerald Kaufman to spearhead some... You know, we used to see it with MPs, just regurgitating gibberish from central office. But these letters arrived, they're all identical, you know.
Cease and desist.
All over. Well, no, not legal letters. Letters from apparently from readers complaining about my homophobia. And so I just used to, you know, tease him. Saying one day the editor, Alan Rusbridge, came over and said, look, I've had Mandelson on. He said, you can't write anything now. You can't, unless you must check it with his office. So I had a nice young guy working for me or with me, you know. So I said, all right, well, that's the edict, so be it. So I said to this guy, Mandelson had this assistant called Benjamin Wegg Prosser. Known to me as Oofy after the P.T. Woodhouse character. So I said, could you ring Oofy and say to him that we've just heard a rumour that Mandy I can't remember, has joined up with Mr. Motivate or something, and he's releasing a fitness video called Fitness for the Over 40s. So he rang up and it was denied. So I think I invented something called the World Rapid Rebuttal. Do you remember Rapid Rebuttal? Yeah. It was denied within sort of 0.47 seconds. And the next day I said, could you ring Mandy's office and say, we've just heard another rumour that, you know, he was the MP for Hartlepool, that there's an injury crisis at Hartlepool United and Mandy's been drafted in as cover, emergency cover at centre-back for Saturday's trip to Scunthorpe. And then there was a new World Rapid Rebuttal record set at 0.33. And the third day I said, could you please ring the office and say we've heard, and this comes from the most unimpeachable sources, that Mandy is planning to take the entire summer off in order to grow a beard after the style of ZZ Top. And about 10 minutes after that, Alan Rusbridge came over and said, from now on you are to check nothing whatsoever with his office. But, I mean, there is an obvious truth that that these people, they like being feared and they don't mind being hated, but they cannot bear being laughed at.
Also, it's amazing how quickly they responded, because the idea was that during the Blair years, they ran this elite media team. I was working on the Telegraph at the time.
Yeah.
You quite often would ring up Labour Party and ask for a piece in the name of Mandy or Tony Blair, and some idiot would go, oh, yeah, we'll get your piece in about a week. It was the same Tory central office. They were given this supposedly magical aura, because politics is very important. They weren't.
Well, I don't know how bothered they'd have been about the Labour appearing in the Telegraph any more than the Tories in the Guardian. But well, they were effective in intimidation.
Yes, about that sort of thing, about personal things, I suppose.
Yeah.
Or one of the most chilling moments in my life was dining with you in a lovely Greek restaurant in Primrose Hill a couple of years ago, and suddenly I saw the world's fakest smile from two people, one of you, and then on the other side of the room, Alistair Campbell, who gave you a smile that looked like murder.
Yes, well, Alistair Campbell was, I did persecute relentlessly for 20 years plus, and he didn't take that. But I think with bullies, anything you can do is try to bully them back. And he had a death list of five people. His son told a mutual friend, a shared friend. And it was John Humphreys, Paul Dacre, formerly editor-in-chief of the Mail Group, Michael Howard for some reason, some manager who walked out on Burnley Football Club halfway through the season, and me.
Badge of honour, I'd say.
Oh, huge. Yeah. I haven't had many, but that was right up there. Yeah. No, you want to be hated by these people if you're a journalist. And not now, because we live in an age when newspapers are virtually irrelevant. I mean, the only power they have is that politicians think they're powerful.
Or they can still break stories, kind of, which are picked up by...
When did they last break a huge exclusive story of any value?
Well, it doesn't spring to mind.
There's no resources. So they are... They've sort of died as we knew them.
And Matthew, you're also a brilliant sports journalist, and you wrote a book, You Cannot Be Serious, 101 Most Infuriating Things in Sport, and you have the combination of a complete obsession with sport, which often leads to great disappointment. Jokes aside, not least as a Spurs fan.
Yes, well, I mean, you know, that's part of it, really. It's the Jewish club, and it carries. I mean, there's an old joke that whenever Spurs score in the first 5 minutes at what was White Hart Lane, whatever it's called now, you hear 5,000 voices in the West End going, it's too early, it's much too early. So if you want a perfect tutorial on how to prepare for disappointment, you become a Spurs fan, because it's almost nothing else.
But sports fans are like that anyway. I'm an Arsenal fan. I remember in the Invincible season, where we were unbeaten all season, even then there were a group of old git sitting beside me just going, Wenger's got to go, he's got to go.
So, yeah.
Unbeaten.
I know. Football fans are morons, aren't they?
Why is that? It's an expectation of supreme constant success, isn't it?
I don't know, but the defining trait of the professional football fan is self-pity, I think. And a sense that this is being done, a defeat has been orchestrated only to damage you personally. So you hear the imbeciles ringing in the wake of England's narrow departure from a tournament, and it's always in that tone. You know, I've given up time to watch them, and they've done this to me. Football fans are dreadful.
With this mad expectation that England should win every single major trophy.
Well, exactly.
They've done rather well the last 20 years, you know.
Yeah, but there's a psychological block, which we're quite close to breaking.
This 1966 jinx, you mean?
No, it all stems back. The first match I ever saw as a kid, a full match live, was the quarterfinal in 1970 in León, Mexico, against West Germany, as was, in which we led 2-0 before your time. And Alf Ramsey took Bobby Charlton off to rest him for the semi, and then it started to go wrong. And I was sent to bed at full time. I was, what, six? And to spare me the inevitable horror, but I could hear the commentary through the wall, and I cried. That's the first time I cried myself to sleep over football. And that had two catastrophic results, that match. One, because the two scorers for England were both Spurs players, Mullery and Peters. I became a Spurs fan. And secondly, it inculcated that sense of disaster and despair and resignation, that however good things look, it's going to end in terrible tears.
And is that why things like Luke the Nuke Littler winning the championship is extraordinary? Because it's like a script. Here he is, this boy, doesn't disappoint.
Yeah, I mean, we've actually got quite Emma Raducanu when she won, and not since. We do produce a young Rooney or Michael Owen. We do produce fully formed, you know, like even as Athena sprung fully formed from the head of Zeus.
Classics never goes away.
Never. They arrive. Usually they do disappoint. Like Raducanu's really done nothing since, and Rooney and never quite fulfilled a massive potential to be a generational great. But sport is really more about disappointment than how you cope with the disappointment than the rare moments of joy.
Matthew, you wrote an extremely moving piece in the Oldie about the sad death of both your parents in recent years.
Yeah.
And you have given a brilliant talk on assisted death. It looks like it's going to go through in a form that you will approve of or not.
I don't know if it will. I mean, the last I read it was about to not go through because this country is so sclerotic. It may change in the era of Trump. It may be break the logjam, but everything, you know, we've been talking about building nuclear power plants for 30 years, nothing. Second runways, nothing. Nothing happens here except talk. So whether this will ever happen, I don't know. It will happen eventually, but it could take another 10 years. But it is needed.
Because in your very moving piece, you wrote about how you fought tooth and nail so that your parents could die a decent death.
Yeah, it was a struggle. In their last days, both of them, for different reasons, were nearly hospitalised. And I had to put a stop to it. Because for all their brilliance at keeping people alive, most doctors, even the good ones, are not good at recognising the imminence of death, and their instinct, which is perfectly natural, is always to do something rather than nothing. But there comes a time in a human life when doing something is inadvertent cruelty and doing nothing is the only humane thing you can do. When I say doing nothing, I mean doing anything to extend life when it barely deserves the name life. But they do that, and so thousands, tens of thousands of people die miserably in hospital. And I was determined that my parents wouldn't, you know, because what is the point of extending a life that's run its course for a few days or a couple of weeks, barely conscious? It's madness.
The difficulty with all this is, what tests would you install to make sure, you know, people aren't knocked off, etc.?
Well, I think what they've suggested, it would have to have some kind of legal oversight. Two independent doctors plus some kind of independent person, whether a high court judge, I think that's been dropped as a prerequisite. But I mean, it's working out. I mean, people talk rubbish about the Canadian version and...
that it was a slippery slope, that's what they say.
Yeah, I mean, I think the state, any state, organically will not relinquish power. And this is one form of power, to deny people the right over their own fate. Obviously, nothing brings that out. You as one of our great legal minds.
And you too. I haven't referred to your legal
mind. You haven't, but it's probably as well. given that it never really took off. But, I mean, nothing brings out the wickedness in people like the prospect for inheritance. So there, obviously, there is a clear and present risk of people manipulating parents and trying to basically bump them off. But, you know, the art of seeking improvement is not to look for perfection. There are going to be problems.
And you also add in an insistence that the people themselves have signed something when they're well to say they're happy for this to take place.
Yeah. I mean, I think it could be included or an addendum to lasting powers of attorney, which I'm in the process of doing for my wife and me, because it's almost, as someone said recently, it's almost more important than having a will. Because if I slipped out, coming out the bath and banged my temple on the sink and became a gibbering, drooling, you know, vegetable, if someone doesn't have power over the medical and the property, then it's a massive nightmare. So I think everyone, there should be government information films telling everyone at the age of 50 to do this, and it should be subsidised, because it is horrendous if you don't have them in place. If I hadn't had them in place, I think my mother would have died in an ambulance. Because I wouldn't have had the power to fight them off.
And we'll finish on an unusual friendship you had with the late Bernard Manning.
Well, again, I wouldn't necessarily call it a friend. I mean, we were on friendly terms. When I was very young at the Mail on Sunday, I think Bernard was the first comic to bring out a video of live performance. So I had to go to the Tower Records opposite the office and buy this video. And I, you know, as I said, disgustingly smug North London liberal of the kind that you fly abroad to avoid. And I would never to be able to serve by a young black woman, which was dreadful. And I tried to explain
good
why.
Columnar material.
Yeah. Anyway, and then I watched it and I was scowling at the telly when a video was playing. And after about 10 minutes, I started laughing, and then I was helpless. And I was just fascinated because this guy was so talented, and yet he completely destroyed his career by the cussedness of refusing to drop those 2 or 3, 4 minutes in an hour that were revolting. And
it was that low, was it? The quotient
wasn't huge. I mean, the Jewish jokes, which I might,
yes,
yeah, yeah, were affectionate because he had some quarter Jewish himself, and the Asian jokes were kind of, but the black jokes, some of them were just disgusting beyond belief. But I mean, so I got fascinated with him, and used to go to Manchester. And a friend of mine, got him interested, and he wrote Bernard's biography.
What's he called?
Yep. Jonathan Margolis. And so when we went to, and I was a restaurant critic as well, so we go a couple of times a year, go to Manchester, and we go and visit Bernard in his. He had this house in a very unpretentious, ungrand part of Manchester, kind of place where a young pharmacists or, you know, young middle management might live. And he had this house which was not grand, and he used to sit in his chair in his sitting room in his giant underpants and a not particularly freshly laundered string vest and his socks, with a Daily Mirror racing page open and betting on the racing. Oh, aye, come in, son. Oh, aye, got a couple of Jews in. Oh, aye. And he was a very endearing man with some disgusting, you know, opinions. Well, you know, and he had this mantle that ran the entire, like, 30, 40 feet, the entire length of this room. And, that's me there with the Duke of Edinburgh there at the Royal Variety, and that's me there with the Duke of Kent. All right, gormless bastard he was. And you go along, that's me there with Franny Lee and Mike Somerby at Man City, and there's me with Sir Alex. And you went along, and on about the fourth visit, I got towards the end of the mantle, and there was a candle with the image of Enoch Powell. And I said, Bernard, why? He said, it's all right, son, I've got rid of the bust of Hitler, made a nice few quid on that. And then on about the sixth visit, I picked it up and turned it around, and he was, you know, strangling an Asian man behind him. So he had some fairly unpalatable views.
But you went to his show, and I think he picked you out in the audience, didn't he?
Well, we went once with a few of us. He said, ladies and gentlemen, we've got some folks in tonight from London, from the London Evening Standard. He said, they're all Jews, so they've sat there 2 hours, not bought a fucking drink. Unbelievable. But he was brilliant. He was the best joke teller I've ever seen.
A perfect delivery, was it?
Oh, the timing, the elliptical brilliance. just take him a fraction of a moment to establish the character. And he was extremely talented and could have been huge, I think. But he was willing to sacrifice his career on the altar of his own cussedness.
And will you finish with one of his jokes, please?
All right, well, this is my all-time favourite joke, certainly Bernard's joke, which I'll have to do in his style. Jewish fella hired me on his deathbed. He says to his wife, he said, "Are you there, Becky, are you there?" She said, "I'm here." He said, "Once again, you're by my side." He said, "When we were growing up in the old country, the Cossacks came and they pogromed the village, torched the house. Ay, ay, ay," he said. "We had to leave in the middle of the night with what we could carry in our hands. We fled in the night," he said. "It was a terrible trauma for a boy," he said. "But you went through it and you were there and you were by my side." She said, "I was, Jaime." He said, "Then the Germans came," he said, "took us in." "Even now," he said, 50 years later, "I cannot speak of what we went through." He said, "It was unimaginable, but through even that unspeakable nightmare, Becky, you were by my side." She said, "I was." So then we were liberated by the Allies who came to England, set up the business, everything was great. And then the recession. "Ay, ay, ay," he said, "after everything. Wiped us out," he said. "We had to sell the house, take the kids out of the school." He said, "After everything we survived, it was another savage blow." He said, "But through that as well, Becky, you were by my side." He said, "And now I'm lying here dying. Once again, you're by my side. Becky," he said, "you're a fucking jinx."
Brilliant place to stop my interview with the great Matthew Norman. Thank you so much, Matthew,
great pleasure,
for appearing on Radio Aldie. You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get 3 trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every 6 issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial" as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial".